Hi, I'm Katie, and you're listening to the Home Ed Voices podcast, where I talk to people about their home education adventures and experiences here in the UK. This week, I'm chatting with Eloise Rickman from @MightyMother_. We talk about her new book, Extraordinary Parenting, about writing it during lockdown, and about how it's a unique source of comfort and support for parents and home educators during this pandemic. For a chance to win a copy of the book, go to our Instagram @HomeEdVoicesPodcast. And now, on with the episode. This week, I'm talking to Eloise Rickman, who is Mighty Mother on Instagram. Hello, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem at all. Right, let's start with, tell me a bit about your family.
Yes, so I am Eloise. I live in South London with my husband, Sam, who is a university researcher, and my daughter, Frida, who is 5 years old. And we have been home educating Frida from the start.
Excellent. Now, you've got a book out.
Yes, I do.
You've got a book out called Extraordinary Parenting.
That's right.
Given the state of the world, actually, do you know what? Let's start with, what is the book about?
Okay. So, yes, I have a book out called Extraordinary Parenting, which came out in May. And it is really, the subtitle of the book is The Essential Guide to Parenting and Educating at Home. I kind of hope the book is what it says on the tin. But really, I wrote it as an encouraging, kind of supportive read for parents who were finding themselves perhaps spending more time at home with their children or navigating uncertainty in their families. And I really wanted it to be an encouraging book which would give parents tools to really strengthen their relationship with their child and to also feel encouraged and empowered when it came to educating their children at home, be that being a full-time home educator like our family, or getting through the months of uncertain home educating, which has come with the coronavirus pandemic, or perhaps parents who want to dip their toes in and try some homeschooling, or maybe parents who just want to do the early years at home. So I've really written the book to be as inclusive as possible, I suppose, to people's circumstances. I wanted it to be a book where even if you're not homeschooling at all, you can still get lots out of it. Because of course, even parents who do send their children to school, will be dealing with homework and weekends and holidays and so on. So I really hope that people who read it feel that there's something in there for them, no matter who they are.
Yeah, completely. So given that it came out in May, and it is, it is geared towards life under a pandemic that we are having at the moment. Like, what's the story of the book?
Yes, that's a good question. So, yes, it did come out in May, and I really had the idea for the book pretty early on in lockdown, actually. I think it was the 22nd of March. I know it was a Sunday. And so my normal work, if you like, when I'm not home educating, is I am a parenting writer and parent educator. So I work with parents all around the world on courses around evidence-based peaceful parenting and education, not just home education, though I do have a course on home ed. But I also talk about different kind of models and approaches and philosophies of education too. So Montessori, Waldorf, and so on. And I really felt like all of my work around education and parenting was suddenly in hot demand. You know, for the first time ever, I had companies getting in touch, for example, asking me to deliver workshops for their employees. And I had so many messages from parents all around the world going, what do we do? There's this pandemic happening. And I really didn't know how to be kind of service. It's such a cheesy word to use, but I really felt like I wanted to use my skill set to support parents as much as I could. But I really wasn't sure if writing another blog post or, you know, putting out more information online was the way to do that. And I think I felt quite overwhelmed by being online in general and by the amount of information that was being shared online. And I don't know if you felt this, but certainly when the pandemic was just getting going, I felt like I was already spending so much time online, you know, just checking news updates and trying to figure out what was happening, that I really didn't want to add to that online noise. And at the same time, I felt that although there is a wealth of parenting information out there, and I talk about many of my favorite parenting books in Extraordinary Parenting, and there's a whole list of resources that I have drawn upon in there, but suddenly so much of what we were reading felt like it was out of step with our current reality. And I really felt like what I really want to read right now is something which kind of makes sense for this time that we're in now and will feel encouraging and supportive. And I was actually in a really fortunate position. I already had a literary agent because I was already working on a proposal for another book, which I'd been kind of dithering over for a while. And I just sent her an email going, Carrie, I've had a thought. What if I wrote a short, easily accessible book in order to support parents at the moment? You know, would there be any appetite for that, do you think? And I think the publishing business is notoriously incredibly slow. So I kind of said to her, look, I don't know how fast publishers can move. Do you think it's something we should try? And she was kind of like, you know what? Normally it takes a couple of years, but I wonder if, given the current situation, this might be something that people would be interested in. And I mean, she was amazing. Actually, it's interesting. My literary agency is up in Oxford, where you are.
Oh, right.
But I had a chat with her, and within 4 days, we had pulled together a proposal, and she had sent it out to publishers, and she had two publishers who were interested, which is just a Herculean effort on her behalf, really. So that was it. You know, on the Sunday, I had the idea, and on the Friday, we had picked a publisher and signed up. And on my proposal, I had said that I would deliver the book in 2 weeks, which felt kind of wild.
Good Lord.
Given that I hadn't started writing it. But we did it. And yeah, I got it out there. I got it to the publishers in 2 weeks. And my publisher told me afterwards that she thought I was mad and I would never get it to her. But we managed to do it. I got it to her in 2 weeks. And yeah, it took just under 2 months for the book to be published.
My goodness. How did you write it? For people who haven't read the book, this is a proper book. This is a proper book that makes coherent sense. Like, not only makes coherent sense, but actually ties very interesting ideas together and really gives, you know, I mean, you've got a really strong arc to the book, and each chapter knows exactly what it's doing, and I'm sure that helps. But you're pulling in ideas from all different places, and you're tying them together in a coherent way. And you're doing this at the beginning of the pandemic when most people couldn't think straight. And I'm guessing you were in a very similar position to that. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
How did you write a book in 2 weeks? That is genuinely incredible. I'm very impressed.
I think I was probably really helped by the fact that I am a serial procrastinator. So as one of my really good friends told me when I was panicking, she was like, Eloise, let's not pretend, but if you had 2 years to write this book, you wouldn't be writing it in 2 weeks anyway.
Yeah,
I'm very motivated by a very tight deadline. Yeah. I think it probably comes from university, where I would, you know, cram out my essays at 5 o'clock in the morning, which is, you know, for anyone listening to this who's a student, that is not a good idea. Don't do it. I think I was really, in all seriousness though, I think I was in a lucky position where, although a lot of the book I did write from scratch, some of it was based on writing that I had previously done. So although I haven't written a book before, I do have years of blog posts, and, you know, I've written at the time of writing the book, I'd written 5 online courses, and also a membership group, so a peaceful parenting membership group. So every month I was delivering content for that as well. So although it's not a copy and paste job, I don't want to give the impression that it is.
No, not at all.
It was really useful to have already done a lot of research and a lot of reading. I didn't have to do a huge amount of new research for the book. And it was a case of kind of, you know, tying certain things together and then writing to fill those gaps. And so I wasn't just working with a blank page. I don't think it would have been possible otherwise, especially as my husband, you know, works as well and we had no childcare. But I mean, my husband was amazing. He took a week off work at very short notice. At a time when his work was incredibly busy as well. And so, you know, without that, it just wouldn't be possible because I usually work one day a week. So I couldn't have written it in 2 days, but I did basically work kind of flat out for a week or so. And then, yeah, it was probably written in about 10 sort of working days. But yeah, it was really a stressful project, but very cool as well. And my editors were amazing. You know, my first editor gave it a really good look over and kind of, you know, spotted where I could maybe strengthen things. And then they had a second editor who read it through and went through more kind of line edits. Does this make sense? Where has this research come from? Yeah. You know, this kind of contradicts what you've said here. So I definitely, without my editors, it would be in much sloppier shape, so I have to give them credit as well. But yeah, it was a really in many ways a very satisfying project to do so quickly. It feels very strange still that I have written a book and had it published, I think, because it's something I have wanted to do for so long, and then to have it happen like that so quickly, I think, yeah, it was probably a case of being the right person in the right place at the right time. And as I said before, I was lucky to have already a literary agent who knew my work and believed in what I was doing. I think otherwise it would have been, you know, kind of impossible. But it also makes me feel like when I write my next book, which I'm sort of slightly planning at the moment, I feel like it's going to feel like a very slow process for me. And I'm not very patient, so I think it's probably going to be more difficult for me to write something longer than it is for me to cram something out.
But then you might still do it in the 2 weeks if you procrastinate for long enough.
Yes, exactly. I probably will.
Yeah, it seems to me that you were the right person in the perfect situation to actually pull it off, basically.
Yes. Yeah, I think it was. It was a good combination of, as I said, having been in this space for so long. And I think it was important to me that the book wasn't just about parenting and it wasn't just about education. And I think that the fact that I, you know, this is the sphere that I work in, I'm not just a parenting coach and I don't just write about education. I think it was a good combination of skills, I suppose, and being able to pull on all about writing and research, which at times over the years has felt, you know, exhausting and a lot, but I felt so grateful that I had that because I was able to then, yeah, build something on top of it. So I feel really fortunate and, you know, very, very grateful and very privileged to be able to share my words more widely with people as well. So yeah, I'm incredibly grateful for the fact that I was able to do it.
That's so not the story I thought you were going to tell. I mean, we hadn't discussed that before. I told you this is what I wanted us to talk about in part, but like, it's so not what I expected. That's amazing. You know,
there you go. Well, there you go.
I mean that in a good way. Like, I don't, you know, that's really quite incredible. I guess also, like, I could see that, you know, given the circumstances, knowing that you actually genuinely could help people who read this book, that's fuel. Like, that's good fuel to get words on pages.
Yeah, it really was. And I do think that, you know, again, not everyone will take in information the same way I do. We know that as home educators, right? Like, people don't all learn in the same ways. But I know that for me, having a book is really helpful. Like, whenever I want to learn about anything, that is my go-to. And I really hope that having that on the shelves, and actually it's been really, really moving. I've had so many lovely messages from people just telling me that actually the book has already made a big impact on their daily life, and it's really reassured them and it's made them feel like they're better able to cope with what's going on at the moment, which, you know, it always feels uncomfortable talking about your own work in this way, but that has been such a beautiful reward, you know, so much more. And, you know, again, this is kind of cheesy, but so much more than the financial reward of doing it, being able to know that actually your words are sitting on someone's shelf, having been read, is just really special. And I mean, I do. I'm not sure that it's what I would necessarily recommend to anyone writing a book in that way. But it was really cool to be able to work in an agile way in order to meet what I perceived of as a need. What I also was really encouraged by is the fact that actually, you know, we had, as I say, not just one, but two publishers who were willing to take it on as a project, yeah. Which makes me feel like actually, you know, quickly signing up a book on peaceful parenting and home education, you know, those aren't necessarily the most mainstream of subjects, although I think they're both gaining in popularity at the moment, which is very heartening. Yeah. That feels kind of cool, you know, the fact that actually this is becoming more mainstream now. And maybe, you know, this kind of pandemic homeschooling is going to be kind of, you know, almost the gateway drug for some people to more long-term homeschooling. And I've spoken to, and I think I talk about this in the book, you know, I spoke to many families who are absolutely devastated by the coronavirus impact. And I don't want to make light of that at all. You know, it has been absolutely devastating for so many, and I think we will probably feel the ricochets of what's been happening for years to come. But I also have spoken to so many parents who are perhaps talking a little more quietly about this, but saying, you know, actually, this has been amazing. It's given me the opportunity to try out homeschooling where, you know, perhaps they had partners who didn't really see how homeschooling could work, or, you know, perhaps they just didn't have the confidence in their own abilities. And I've had so many messages from people who have seen their children just transformed by being at home and being out of school. And I think that is, again, kind of exciting that we can provide support for families like that who are maybe now testing the waters and having that confidence in themselves as well. So yeah, it will be interesting to see what the landscape in home education looks like. Perhaps, you know, if we keep having coronavirus as something which keeps coming back until we have a vaccine, you know, I'd be excited to see the rise of more formalized flexi schooling, for example. Yeah. So I feel like there is, you know, as I said, I really don't want to push under the carpet the fact that this has been absolutely devastating and horrific. Yeah. But I also feel like there are potentially some positive changes that might be able to come out of it, if not societally, then at least for some families and communities.
Yes, I hadn't thought about the flexi-schooling kind of aspect of it, but that's what's happening now for a lot of, you know, I mean, you know, we bumped into, not physically, obviously socially distanced and all that, but like a friend of my eldest's, and he's in school 2 days a week at the moment, yeah. Because that's how they can get everybody in for some of the time, which
exactly,
you know, for a lot of schools they just wouldn't make possible. I mean, a lot of that is to do with money and whether, you know, and whether they get the full funding and stuff. But if that stuff can be changed, and there are, you know, this is a, you know, unintentional, but this is a trialing of what that means. And I think it's going to be very difficult at the end of that to go, yeah, no, we don't do that. Everybody back into the classroom now. It's all finished. Mostly because I don't think we're going to have a big stop where it's like, everybody got the jab. Hooray. Nothing, you know, this is never a problem. We're going to come out of this in stages.
Yes. Well, I'd hope so. We'll see. I must say, you know what I mean?
Like, there isn't like a big cutoff date where, like, this, you know, part of the problem is this is not going to be over in a month's time. And therefore, it's like, I think that makes it much harder for this, the whole system, not even just like schools, but the whole funding system for schools and whatever, to go, no, we did that. We've got loads of experience of that now, but we're not going to pursue it when there are so many families who would love that, who want that flexibility. They don't want 100% one way or the other, and they're frustrated because they're just not allowed to do it in their area.
I really do hope that it leads to some more flexibility, both around schooling but also in terms of people maybe working more flexibly and working from home, which obviously is, you know, it's the other side of that coin. You know, if you want to have children flexibly educated, you need to have parents who can flexibly earn a living. So I feel hopeful. I don't know if I necessarily feel optimistic, but I would at least like us to continue having those conversations. And I think it's actually really important that although as home educators, you know, like you and I, we we still remember that actually, you know, this is part of our fight too. And that just because we're not in that system, it doesn't mean that we need to stop advocating for that kind of change that's happening within the school system. I would really like to see more kind of support and solidarity between schooled populations and homeschooled populations. And I think we both have probably a lot to offer one another. So again, you know, and I think there's been that kind of sense of, you know, we're all in this together through COVID. And of course, you know, that's not to say that we have all had the same experience, because we certainly haven't, and privilege plays an enormous part in that. But I think there has been a sense of, you know, all of our lives have been shaken throughout this. And I hope that we can keep that sense of sort of solidarity as we move forward and start to kind of rethink what daily life looks like.
Yeah, totally. I think one of the really nice things about the book was that it's actually talking about now. There's, you know, you can go back to an older book, but they feel jarring because the examples they're giving you are things that just you can't do. Do you know what I mean? Hey, go out and like meet loads of people. No, can't do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, go and take your children around the shops. Yep, can't do that either. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that was like, I, you know, that from a personal point of view was really hard to pick up stuff and be like, only some of this is useful to me now because nothing is talking, you know, whereas you say this is written knowing, you know, this is, you know, you wrote this under lockdown as well. So like, you know, there is nothing in this book that you can't use in July of 2020, even if you're in Leicester and you're back down to a proper lockdown or whatever. Like, do you know what I mean? There is stuff in this that's just saying, like, this is where I'm coming from. I'm in your situation as well. But like, look at the things that you actually can, in a sense, it's about what you can actually change.
Yes, exactly.
When and there's many things you can't change, these are the things you actually have control over. Start
absolutely
there.
And I really hope that as well, you know, although I wrote it with the kind of current situation in mind, I also really hope, I mean, I hope it will be useful to any family who reads it, you know, if their life is feeling completely breezy and effortless. But I also really hope that it will help families who are maybe not living through a pandemic, but, you know, I have worked with military families who have to move around a lot and are some, you know, all of a sudden they're uprooted from their communities. And even, you know, families who suddenly have a new baby and your world shrinks a lot when you have a new baby. Or parents who are, you know, having maybe personal issues around maybe they're going through a divorce, or maybe they've just lost one of their family members, or they're caring for a sick or elderly parent. Or, you know, I think there are a lot of times which can feel really challenging and difficult for us to navigate as parents. Even, you know, prolonged periods of sickness, periods where maybe your child is unhappy at school. So I really wanted to try and write it not just with kind of, you know, a pandemic in mind, but trying to write it, like I said, where it feels sort of inclusive to, you don't have to have your shit together to get something out of this book. You know, you don't have to be one of those perfect parents. It just, I hope that wherever people are at, they can take something from it and feel encouraged, and that there are some kind of hopefully simple ideas that they can take as well, without feeling too overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, we were saying before the show, what's nice is because you've pulled so many ideas together and kind of woven them, you know, to show how they link with each other. Even if, you know, you've heard, you know, you've read these ideas, you know, read similar ideas elsewhere and things like that, it becomes like a place you can go back to and be reminded, you know, because we all fall into patterns. We all fall into the day, you know, the week follows week follows week.
Yes.
You actually come back and go, do you remember this idea? And actually to see how it works with this idea. And you go, oh God, yeah. And it just, without having to pull out a big stack of books and go, okay, I'm going to read all my this and all of that again. Just actually have things, they're pulling these things together to remind you. Do you know what I mean?
That
these are the things you have control. And I mean, to me, you know, there are times, you know, so many people within home education and homeschooling or whatever, you know, Novembers are often very hard because you've been through the start of the new school year and all the shine is just starting to come off all of the new things or whatever, you know, and it's starting to get darker and colder. And the Februaries and the Marches that just go on forever, where you feel like spring is never going to come. Even those, which are little dips, in comparison to what we're going through at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, but I can see, you know, being able to come back to there. You wrote a book that was a comfort, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, that's so lovely. That's exactly what I hoped for. So that makes me very happy.
In a way that other things can't be a comfort. Do you know what I mean? Like, we went through a phase with the kids, which they just seem to calm down a bit now, where you would watch something and they'd be like, why are those people standing together? Because this was made 4 years ago. Yeah, but it's weird. I don't like it. It's like, yeah, I know. Yeah. Look at this. Look when it was made.
I know. It feels so weird, doesn't it?
And it does. You know, like, I understood they couldn't enjoy it. And as an adult, I couldn't enjoy that stuff for a while. Because I'm just like, I want to sit next to somebody. And do you know what I mean? And be able to have a face-to-face conversation with them. So I'm jealous of the person in the screen. But also it feels weird and it feels unsafe.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I do think that there is, you know, there is something in there, isn't there? That feeling of like, this is really jarring and really strange. And I think we were talking before we started recording about how, you know, it's weird now that things are, you know, starting to lift slightly, that sense of what's safe now, what am I allowed to do, what's okay, is it okay to, you know, stand near someone but not give them a hug, but what if I accidentally infect them? And it's a very bizarre mental landscape to be inhabiting, I think.
It's ambiguous.
Mm.
And I think that it's been harder for people to come, it's harder to shift into that mentality. It was really upsetting to go into the lockdown and suddenly realize that your world was shrinking, getting smaller and smaller. Assuming you were, obviously, like, I guess my caveat by saying there are obviously going to be people listening to this who have people who work outside of the home and who maybe work outside of the home themselves. And, you know, like, so I accept that the lockdown with everybody staying at home is only one version of the lockdown that people have experienced.
Yes.
But I think even for people who worked outside the home, you're suddenly seeing all these things changing. You know what I mean? You're seeing empty shelves, and you've got all these new protocols that you have to deal with, and, you know, your life is dramatically changing as well, kind of thing. You can see the devastation. Like, I think, you know, the amount of people who had weird dreams.
Yeah.
Social distancing dreams. Did you have social distancing dreams?
I didn't, actually, but my husband had a spate of having very bizarre dreams.
I had lots of dreams where I felt very uncomfortable about being close to people. And if there were a lot of people in my dream, I did not like it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think from there, it'd be really interesting to know, like, kind of, you know, why, how did you start home educating, you know, within your family?
So I think we have always hoped to be able to home educate. I should say that I didn't always know that it was going to be a possibility. So before I had Frida, my daughter, I was working full time in a busy office as a senior government press officer. So not at all the kind of job that, I do now. And it certainly wasn't a job that felt very family friendly, which is probably a whole other podcast conversation for another day. But I think I came out of that experience feeling quite disheartened, especially as a feminist who also believes that motherhood should be really valued. Because when I talked to them about going back part time, you know, it was their response was very negative. And I think it's probably not a coincidence that every woman I know who got pregnant there ended up leaving and not coming back, which is such a shame. And I do understand, you know, press office tends to be a pretty, you know, high energy. You've got to often go on trips with ministers at the drop of a hat and so on. But I also feel like that job could definitely be done part-time really easily. Anyway, I won't talk about that more. But it's to say that when I got pregnant, I didn't imagine myself home educating. I really did genuinely see myself coming back to work part-time, maybe having her in nursery part-time, and then, being able to still have some time with her before she eventually went off to school. But then we had her, and I think it really brought me back to reflecting on my own childhood and what kind of childhood do we want to have for her? What do we want to offer her? What do I want my motherhood to look like? And I was home educated until I was 6 and a half. So for people who are listening in the UK, I went to school in year two. But until that, I was fully at home. So I didn't go to nursery or childcare. and I was home educated. And for me, that was just such a gift, I think. And again, I talk about this a little bit in the book, but, you know, my parents did not have much money at all. I'm sure they would not mind me saying that. Yeah. But, you know, they really struggled, I think, financially. But for me, I didn't feel like it was a lesser or a poorer childhood. I think I felt like my childhood was actually incredibly rich. And I grew up in Brighton by the sea and next to a beautiful park, St. Answell's Park. And so every day we would either go to the beach or we would go to the park or we would go to the beach and the park. And we went to the library a lot and went swimming. And yeah, it was just a really idyllic start to life, I think. And, you know, my parents would tell me stories and read me books and play with me and, you know, repurpose old cardboard boxes to be puppet theatres. And yeah, it was a pretty simple childhood, I think, in many ways, but a really beautiful one. I think often, you know, the books now, like Simplicity Parenting and, you know, this kind of whole movement to slow down childhood and reclaim childhood, I feel like that is the kind of childhood I had, really. It was just very lovely and beautiful. And then my mum had my brother, and at this point I think they were also really needing some more money, so my mum went to work and she had my younger brother, and so I started school. And school was fine, you know, went to my local state school and then local state senior school, sixth form college, and it was all fine. You know, I was talking to my dad about this recently, and he was saying he remembers when I must have been in year three or something, and it's the time when you still did weekly spelling tests. And I think I was very lucky because my home education in my early years, I think, had given me, I was already reading kind of really fluently. And I think a lot of what I did with my parents, even though they didn't really do anything structured with me, I think it still gave me a bit of a head start academically. Yeah. And so I was in, you know, all the sort of top sets, which is such a thing that I have such an issue with, the whole idea of sets. But anyway, that is, again, probably a big rant for another day. And my dad tells me that he remembers, you know, I would do these spellings every week, but I would always get, there was one word I just couldn't seem to stick in my head how to spell it. I think it was, you know, friend or something. Yeah. And, you know, so every week I would keep getting the same list of spellings. And he was just talking to my teacher and going like, this is ridiculous. She can spell these words. She just can't remember this one. You know, can she keep practicing this one and move on? Because, you know, she can do these with her eyes closed. And they're going, oh, no, you know, we have to show that she has progressed properly through them. And I think for me, that sums up so much of my experience of school. You know, it wasn't bad necessarily. But so much of school felt unpersonal and, you know, really felt like, especially as I got older, I felt like school really denied my autonomy as a person. You know, I remember being outraged in secondary school when some of our teachers would insist that, you know, in the summer you had to wear your jumper, and if you wanted to take it off, you had to raise your hand and ask to take it off. And just something like that, I mean, you know, how dare they control your body in that way? You know, why? And they wouldn't say no, but just that very act of, you know, we want you to submit to us so that we can show you we have control over your body, just felt really wrong. And I was talking again, you know, with my husband the other day about this, that we had, you know, a school uniform policy, as most schools do. And, you know, we were only supposed to wear certain things and certain styles of jewellery even. And I was talking to him about how, you know, even though we were not allowed to wear them, I would always wear these like really big, colourful, plasticky earrings. And every day I'd walk past some teacher in the corridors who would ask me to take them out, or I'd get sent out of a classroom for wearing them. And yet I kept wearing them day after day. And I think there was just a part of me that was really like, you can't take this from me. I'm still my person. Even if you don't like it, even if I get punished for it, I want to keep sticking up for myself. And I mean, there are so many other examples like that. But yeah, although I wouldn't look back on my experience at school and say it was actively terrible, you know, I think I have a lot of privileges, which mean that my experience was probably, you know, it was positive in some ways, and I did make good friends, it isn't what I want for my daughter. And I think the first time I really started enjoying my own education was where I got to sixth form and could pick the subjects I did and wear my own clothes and call my teachers by their names. And suddenly it was like, oh, I'm not here because I'm forced to be here. I'm here because I choose to be here. You know, I want to be here. I love what I'm studying.
Yeah.
And it was suddenly like, wow, this is what studying can feel like. And I threw myself into it and I absolutely loved it. And I think that experience really made me feel like, oh, you know, school takes these things and it makes them, you know, it takes them away from you. It takes away your autonomy and your choice. And no matter how much you might enjoy a certain subject, if you're being forced to do it, that takes away so much of the joy. So, yeah, I think it had always been sitting in my mind that I would like to educate in a different way, but I didn't ever think it was possible. And then when it turned out that I really didn't want to go back to my old work again, you know, I keep saying this, but it really is worth saying, it's a huge privilege to even be able to have these conversations. But I had so many sleepless nights and talks with my husband where I was just like, I really don't want to go back. I don't want to send Frida to a nursery. You know, we went and visited a couple and it just made me feel so sad, the idea of kind of handing her over to someone else when I was enjoying motherhood so much. It felt like the first time in my life I was doing something which I felt naturally like I just loved doing it, you know. I felt like all the jobs I'd had before were just jobs. I was doing them to get paid, and suddenly I was doing something for the love of it and for the love of this person, and I didn't want to stop. So yeah, we kind of, I didn't go back to work and ended up training as a doula and as an antenatal educator, and then slowly growing my business that I run now. And it suddenly started to seem possible that maybe not only would we not have to send Frida to nursery, but actually we wouldn't have to send her to school. And I was surprised at the beginning because my husband in many ways had quite a different experience to me. So he went to nursery from a young age, went to school. And the school he went to was very different to mine. It was a religious fee-paying school. But he also didn't really enjoy it. And I think we both, you know, I felt like I wanted to give Frida those early years that I had. And I felt like Sam didn't necessarily want to give her some of, you know, those school experiences that he had had. And again, I think for both of us, it wasn't, we didn't really come at it from a place of we hate school, but more of we think there could be something better for her. So yeah, it was a decision I think we both really agreed on, even though we had had quite different upbringings, which again is amazing because I speak to so many families where one parent feels strongly about home education and the other parent feels strongly about school. So it's not something we would have anticipated pre-having a child, but yeah, it is where we both kind of naturally lay. So yeah, it feels like it was just a kind of a very natural decision for us, but I can see how it was influenced by, you know, my early childhood certainly. And I think, you know, I studied anthropology as a teenager at university. And even just that course, you know, seeing that actually there is more than one way to raise a flourishing, happy child.
Yeah.
And more of one way of defining education and learning about colonialism and how education has been used in colonialism. I think these all kind of laid the groundwork for us to go, you know what, we're gonna do this our way instead. And it feels like such an absolute joy and privilege to be able to do that. I absolutely love home educating.
I think the thing is that like education is a kind of machine. And for some people, it's really, you know, it's a really useful machine. It allows, you know, it gives their children a safe place to learn the thing, the skill, you know, the skills they need, whilst the adults go and earn a living. And that's yeah. how you're making your family work. But it's still a machine. It still wants you to conform. It doesn't. You know, for all the talk of individualizing this and whatever, as you say, individualizing often is like, well, we'll stream you if you're good, you can go to this and then whatever, and if you're, you know, if you're not, if you haven't attained enough to get into that top section, you're going to linger a little bit in this middle bit.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, again, we're really lucky. You know, our daughter has a lot of privilege where probably if she went to school, she you know, would benefit from a lot of those privileges. You know, she's white, she's middle class, she has parents who can advocate for her. And we know that things like racism have a huge impact on children's experiences of school and what sets they end up in and how, you know, how their teachers predict their attainment. We know, for example, that with black children, their attainment and their grades are often really under predicted by their teachers, and they end up doing much better. So, you know, even with, with all of those myriad privileges, but I think as well, you know, it's so much worse probably for children who don't have those privileges. And it, that feels particularly cruel, I think.
Well, yes. When you were saying about like like wearing the earrings and stuff, and I was thinking at the time, like when you were saying about it, I was thinking, not like, oh, well, it's okay for you because you're white, but just like kind of like we see our privileges, and we can, you know, as adults, we can look and be like, oh yeah, that time I rebelled. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I didn't get into trouble for it because, you know, particularly being, you know, as we both are, like white women who were white girls.
Yes, exactly.
You could get away with stuff at school. Like if you were a good student and you were a white girl, if you did something wrong, it wasn't the end of the world.
Exactly. And I mean,
you wouldn't have, you know, you wouldn't have if you were a boy, to be honest. And if you're a bit of a scrappy boy, same misdemeanor, you know. And that's even if you were white. That's not even taking into race, which then you know, where you're just going to get flattened by it.
Exactly. And I mean, I was always in trouble, you know, I was always doing detentions and, but it was never, you know, I was never expelled or excluded. You know, and my parents didn't really care. I think they were just like, oh, you know, it's just, you're railing against the system again. Whereas I know that for a lot of families, and again, that in itself is a privilege, not really being able to mind if your child gets detentions and things. Because, you know, for a lot of parents, I think, you know, maybe if you're a black family and you know well that actually it takes less for your child to be excluded than it will for a white child. And you know that there is a proven link between getting expelled from schools and ending up, you know, in prisons and so on. There's been lots of writing done on this. You know, you probably don't have the privilege to be able to say to your child, yeah, it's fine. You know, you do what you need to do at school. Well, exactly. Because you can't, you know, you need to keep your child safe. So I think, yeah, the whole thing is just so mired in, you know, so many different issues. And I think that, I think we sometimes forget, you know, yes, individual teachers are wonderful and, you know, you get some heads who are really trying to make a big difference and a big impact. But fundamentally, schools are institutions. And I think I just felt fundamentally that no institution will ever be able to care and love for my child as much as I can. And I think that's probably so much of why so many of us home educate. And for some of us, it might feel safer. For some of us, it might feel, you know, I don't know, like, you know, for example, I know again that there are lots of black families who are choosing to home educate because they want to keep their children out of that sort of racist system. But yeah, I think for us fundamentally as a family, it just felt like, look, if we can opt out, why wouldn't we, in a sense?
I think also, you know, particularly with the rise of like homework and stuff within primary. Which, you know, was not always the case. It really was, you know, when I went to school, we didn't have homework in primary, which is not to say, oh, it should go back to how it was or whatever. But like, I feel like the rise of homework in primary has really meant that the school starts to impede more and more on family life.
It doesn't
finish at 3 o'clock or 3:30 or whatever when the school, you know, when the final bell goes and you go home or you go into after school club or whatever like that. Like, it's just extending. It's not just this is when you can be together with a family and this is when you can't. It's also, you know, whilst you're together as a family, like, here are loads of jobs for you to do. Here's a to-do list.
To add into
your family life.
Yeah, and I think it really does, you know, it's that kind of encroachment. But I just, it really doesn't sit well with me, that idea of, you know, not only are we controlling where you have to be during the day and what you get to do during the day and when you get to use the toilet during the day. But we're also going to take your time when you're supposed to be relaxing at home, and we're going to take that away from you too. And I feel like fundamentally, you know, it's a social justice issue. You know, we wouldn't treat adults in the same way, but yet we do treat children in this way because we have more power than them. And it's difficult because I ask myself a lot as a privileged home educator, you know, what impact is me taking my daughter out of, you know, well, not even taking her out of school, she was never in school, but what impact does our family opting out of the system have for, you know, social justice implications more widely? You know, would it be better for us to be in school trying to fight the good fight, or is it better for us to opt out? But I do think that, you know, for every parent who opts out and opts out vocally, it's another voice saying you cannot treat children like this. This is not acceptable. You don't get to teach children that they don't get to decide when they have a drink of water or when they go to the toilet or how they spend their time. I feel really strongly that it is a form of, you know, coercive control. We tell children they have to go somewhere, and if they don't go, we punish them. And we tell children that they have to behave a certain way, and if they don't behave like that, we punish them, and we confiscate things from them, and we, you know, take their time away from them, and we tell them when they can eat and when they can move. And I don't know, to me it feels really, it just feels like there is, I think I used to feel that there could be fundamental reform and change within the education system. And I still hope that's possible, but I feel more than ever now that us agitating within the system isn't enough. You know, we need to tear the system down and rebuild something more equitable, based on justice, based on fairness, and based on treating children as humans rather than as, you know, adults to be who we get to form and control in this way. It's definitely a tricky conversation. And this is why I think I was saying earlier that I feel like there needs to be more community between home educating families and families who use schools. And I definitely don't mean this in any form of judgment against parents who send their children to school. I think such a bind because, you know, many families can't afford to just opt out of the system, or they don't want to because they have careers that wouldn't allow that. And, you know, there is zero judgment on any individual family, but I do have a lot of judgment for the system, I think. And again, that goes over the heads of any individual teachers or heads, but I think that we have built such a dangerous and coercive system that I don't see how gentle reform is really possible or would achieve much.
I don't think internal reform particularly works. Yeah, I mean, I can understand. Yeah. Kind of opting out of, you know, I mean, obviously everybody has lots of reasons for why they home educate, and one of them for you know, for me personally, was I just don't want to have to deal with school in my family life in that way, where they're going to tell me what we can do and we can't do for the next you know what, 13 years per kid or whatever.
Yes,
you know what I mean, for like 17, 18 years of my life. Like, I don't want that for us. Let's do something else, because I think it's you can't, you know, parents, even groups of parents, you can't make big changes from within. It's not like if you could convince this head teacher, or you could convince these teachers, like, not to do this thing, then it would be, no, this is a structural problem.
And I think this is the problem fundamentally, and I think this is why so many teachers actually get burnt out and end up home educating, because they push and they push and they push for change, and they realize that actually you might be able to change a few things, but really you are still working within that system.
Well, particularly once there was like the national curriculum, which, you know, has advantages and disadvantages. I mean, my mum trained as a teacher and was a teacher for a number of different subjects and a number of different age groups. And actually, I was talking to her recently about this, and she was saying that, you know, a lot of that, she didn't do a conversion. She did a degree in education kind of thing. And so much of that was like, see what the kids bring in. If someone brings in tadpoles, here's, you know, like, not here's what you would do, but like, you've got to think on your feet, and we're going to give you the skills so that you can start, you can turn learning objectives into things that they are interested in, because, you know, so somebody's gone away and they've brought back a thing from their holiday, or they, you know what I mean, or they bring a book on castles they really enjoy. How can you now expand that out? You know, and you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is that kind of autonomy and freedom that also brings us joy as home educators, right?
Yeah, totally.
It's being able to follow those rabbit trails and going, cool, okay, you're interested in this today, or we've watched that documentary, or you've seen something that one of your friends is chatting about. Like, let's go with that. That's interesting. And it just, yeah, I feel like I've learned so much more in these years of being a home educator than I have for, you know, a long time now. It feels like a far more natural and joyful way to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. And it allows you, because, you know, you can have the comfort, again, a comfort, but you can have the comfort of, say something like we have a really good solid maths curriculum, which the kids get on with. And so I'm not having to think necessarily, okay, how am I going to explain these things to the children? Because it's there. It's in a way that works for us. But then in other cases, like, something comes along and it's like, oh, we're really into that. Okay, wait, well, where can I, you know, like, you're suddenly looking, like, it's fun to be looking for other interesting things, you know.
Definitely.
Not just going to the library and getting 15 books and then reading two of them. Not that that's ever happened millions of times, but you know what I mean? But, like, also, like, oh, well, if we're going to read about that thing, then they might want to know about this thing as well. And I saw that documentary, or, you know what I mean? And then you start, the hive mind of home education starts to churn as other people go, oh, God, well, if you like that, then you should look at this. You know what I mean? And so you're then collaborating with lots of other people.
Yes.
You know, as an interested person, you're surrounded by other interesting interesting people who are sharing that stuff with you. And that's the, you know, never, I was going to say never mind the whole time with your kids, but, like, separate from, I get to see my children achieve the things they are learning and the changing and growing that they are naturally doing. But I also just get to share loads of really interesting stuff with other interesting people as an adult. And that's great.
Exactly. Isn't that fantastic?
It's part of it being a career thing that you do as an educator. Whether you want to call yourself a guide or a facilitator or a teacher or whatever of your children, like, this is a job that we do.
Yeah,
for no money, but with a job that we do. Do you know what I mean? It takes time and effort and hard work and care and thought about doing this thing.
Mm. But this is why I think as well that, you know, I think the idea that work has to be something that you're paid for, but it's validated somehow by a payslip or by an appraisal, is just, you know, it's such a broken way of thinking. And we can absolutely work hard and have a career doing something, but we never get paid, you know, a penny for, and that actually we just do for the love of it. And can I think that, you know, the kind of patriarchal society we live in defines work and success and, you know, being, you know, having a career in very strange and strict terms that I don't know. I just don't buy into that anymore. The idea that your worth is somehow defined by, yeah, your payslip.
But it's hard, isn't it? Because I feel like we were promised we could do anything. And that as young women, we were promised we could do anything. And what we've chosen to do is we've decided that we wanted to be with our people. And we wanted to take the time and energy, even though it wasn't going to pay us anything, to be with our people.
Yeah.
Rather than the alternative. I mean, there are millions of alternatives. There are degrees of alternative. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not trying to make a value judgment on anybody else's decision, because everybody needs to do what's right for them and what's right for their family. But there is a dissonance sometimes, I think, from what we thought we were going to do when we went out into the world at 18, 19 or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Having been told, get a degree in this thing, you can do anything you want, you can, you know what I mean, the world is yours, you can have it all, to then be like, well, to then reject it essentially and be like, well, but what you want for me to do, what I want to do, if I'm, for, you know, to have children or whatever with somebody as part of my life, means I have to choose not to do those things or to do them in a completely different way.
Or to do them
way.
Later.
Or to
do them flexibly or to, yeah, I think there are so many ways, like you say, of being a home educator and pouring yourself into these ways of living. I mean, you know, let's be clear, you know, my husband and I both work and we have in order to, you know, to live, and that feels cool too. But I think, yeah, I really hope that the world that I bring Frieda up into means that if she decides one day that she wants to be a stay-at-home mum or a home educator and that's all she ever wants to do, that she feels really validated and accepted in those choices, because I think they are absolutely work and they're absolutely meaningful work and they are, you know, radical, you know, societal changing work. And I think that this work we do as mothers and as home educators is so valuable and so important, and we, you know, provide not just gift to our children, but, you know, we provide something really valuable to society as well. And I think it's just such a shame that it's seen as women's work, so it's so, so badly undervalued, and, you know, people don't really see it as meaningful. But yeah, I'm hoping that that dialogue will change. And for anyone who wants some more encouragement along those lines, I really recommend the book Liberating Motherhood by Vanessa Olerenshaw, who talks a lot about motherhood and capitalism and feminism and how motherhood needs to be kind of reclaimed again by feminism. I found it absolutely fascinating and a very encouraging read as well.
That sounds fantastic. Again, it's a structural problem. I don't know how you fix that. I don't know how I don't know how you give the worth, because yeah, doing it, this feels priceless. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I am, you know, we've made sacrifices to be able to do this. We make sacrifices, you know, every year to be able to do this kind of thing. And most home ed families I know are in that position. You do it, and, you know, because you believe it is the right thing for your family to do.
Yes.
I don't know how the world, it would take a structural change to give you compensation, you know, because compensation is safety. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think, like, you know, people are already talking about that. Like, you know, political parties are now having more conversations about things like universal basic income and things which would actually provide that safety net for families. And
it would take something like that.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I'm not necessarily hopeful for this government, but I really hope that with enough people agitating and pushing, we will maybe one day get closer to that. And I think, you know, yes, we need structural reform. I think that much is absolutely clear. But also, you know, just by living this ourselves and by showing that there is another way and, you know, being loud and vocal about why we do what we do and trying to bring up and make space for people who find it harder to, you know, have that lifestyle and make those choices because of, you know, whatever inequalities or, you know, positions that they find themselves in. I think, you know, it might not change the structure overnight, but I think that there is definitely, you know, I think we can affect more change than we think sometimes just by kind of living our truth and trying to, yeah, show that there is another way of being, which is actually radical and joyful and, yeah, can may well just change the world.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, throughout this conversation, when we've talked about structural change, I neither of us mean in the sense of like, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it because it just needs a much bigger structural change, whatever. As you say, it's a kind of like, no. Yeah, there needs to be a fellowship between different groups. There needs to, you know, so that we can lift people higher. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, it's only by working together, and as you say, and actually kind of agitating and campaigning and, you know, and talking, you know, speaking our truth in a way of like what it is to do this, and, you know, and amplifying the voices of other people who are speaking their truth. That's how change comes. Because then it becomes more normal, you know, because all the stuff you're talking about becomes more normal. And once it's normal and accepted, then change can start to happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you're listening to this,
we should not be downhearted.
No. Well, if you're listening to this, you know, take that to heart, that actually we make a big difference in our daily lives and we can both, you know, try and change things by how we live, but also, you know, by, you know, keep writing to your MP, keep pushing for change, keep thinking about who you're voting for, you know, this all matters as well. But I do feel like, you know, when, you know, similar to that quote, you know, injustice somewhere is injustice kind of everywhere. I've definitely not got that quote right, but you know the one I mean. And I think it's the same, you know, until all children have a right to be educated in a way that kind of, you know, gives them bodily autonomy and respects their humanity and freedom, then no child is really free in their own education either. So yes, let's keep doing awesome things with our families, but let's also not lose sight of the bigger picture that there's still a lot of work to be done too.
Yeah. But in the doing of it, not just the doing of the bigger work, but in the doing of the everyday stuff, you know, the more of us that there are, and there are more of us, and I'm sure in the next couple of years there are going to be even more of us, the more people who are doing that, it becomes more normal. Do you know what I mean? And the act of doing it, it's not just the marching in the streets and the writing to your MPs and the whatever, which I'm not saying that's what you're saying. I'm just saying, you know, you're right, that it's the living of your everyday life. And the normalising of the everyday life. And just so that other people are not like, who are those weird home educators or whatever? It's just like, oh, yeah. Those people go to school and those people home educate. And do you know what I mean? It's just normal. How are you, you know, how are you doing? I know this is what you do. Tell me what's going on with you kind of thing. Rather than being this like weird anomaly, which we are seeing when we do, you know, I think within our communities, not just within home education, but like our wider home communities, people are just getting used to it. And that is an act. That is the act in itself, I think.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to pull out a quote from your book because I loved it. And I think it's really relevant because we had so many people who have been thrust into the position of like homeschooling their kids, like helping their kids with the schoolwork they've been sent with, which isn't the same as home education, but it's given them a taste of like, this is what life around the kitchen table, whether the kitchen table is your dining table or, you know, lap, you know, sat on the sofa with something over your lap kind of thing. It's still, you've got a taste of the education you could be having that isn't just sending your kids to school. And I just remember reading this quote and I loved it so much. It says, read some more. If all you did for 3 months was read aloud to your kids from a range of great books, they'd thrive.
Yes. I think they really would. I mean that. I think that so often when we think about home educating, you know, especially if we're maybe at the start of our journey, or especially I think if your children have already been in school, so you have that kind of that sense of what education might look like. I think that so often we feel that we have to replicate a classroom in our homes, or we have to get a timetable, or, you know, start immediately with teaching our children with maths worksheets, or you know, teaching them a foreign language. And I think especially if your kids have already been in school and you're pulling them out, maybe this is a time to share amazing books together, watch fantastic documentaries and films, discuss those things, enjoy being together, allow your child some time to kind of decompress and remember what learning can be like. Because at school, you know, no matter how old they are, they will have taken this sense of learning is something that happens to me top down.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as parents, one of the best gifts we can give our children is this period, which homeschoolers often talk about, called a kind of de-schooling period, where you are just trying to shake off those kind of remnants of school in your mentality and in your daily life as well. So yeah, read amazing books to your kids, and, you know, read fiction and nonfiction, and read comic books and poetry books and magazines, and use audiobooks as well. You know, audiobooks are your friend. You get pretty tired reading hour after hour otherwise. So have a mix, have beautiful audiobooks on, listen to lovely music together. You know, go for walks. Yeah, as I said, you know, just and allow the kids to just play. And I think so often we see learning as something that has to look very formalised. But actually, we forget that children are born to learn. You know, children have been learning since the moment they first opened their eyes. And so often as parents, we forget that actually until they went to nursery or until they went to school, we facilitated that learning, not by actively teaching them. You know, how many of us actively taught our children how to walk or how to say their first words? But just by providing love and support and encouragement and the right, you know, the right materials. Maybe we bought them their first pair of shoes. Maybe we chatted to them. And these are the things that we can continue to do. You know, we create an environment for our children in which learning is possible. We create a feeling in our children of respect and unconditional love, where they feel safe to try things and, you know, make mistakes and get things wrong. And I think these are, above all else, the most important things we can do with our children. And this is why, you know, in the book, I talk about the fact that actually, before you even start thinking about education, you know, what that might look like, think first about your relationship with your kids. Think about your home environment. Maybe start thinking about if you want to have a rhythm in your home, and think about how you're going to look after yourself as well. Because although home education, I think, is a joy, and I personally wouldn't do it if I didn't love it, it is also absolutely exhausting. And I think it can be very easy to burn out, because we want the best for our children. And sometimes that can mean that we pour a lot of ourselves into them. So, you know, making sure that you have some, you know, small things in place to ensure that you are looking after yourself as well.
Yeah, completely. Where can people find you?
So I'm on Instagram at Mighty Mother, and it has a little underscore behind it for reasons I can't quite remember. I think Mighty Mother was taken. So I hang out on Instagram a lot of the time. So come and find me over there and say hi. I also have a website called A Beautiful Childhood, which you'll find strangely at www.freedabemighty.com. I really need to do some kind of website management and move those things around, I think. But if you search for A Beautiful Childhood, you will find me. I've also got a free Facebook group called A Beautiful Childhood, which you are very welcome to join. And yeah, come and hang out and say hello. I'd love to hear from you.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And there you go. If you want to find out more about any of the things we talk about in this episode, or to leave a comment, please go to the show notes on the blog at homeedvoices.co.uk, or follow the link on Instagram at homeedvoicespodcast, or Twitter at homeedvoices. Don't forget, you can win a copy of the book by following our Instagram and leaving a comment on the post for this episode. This is episode 29. If you want to support the show, please rate and review at Apple Podcasts, as it helps more people to find out about it. The Homemade Voices podcast is an independent production and is created, hosted and produced by me, Katie Hanrod. The podcast theme tune is Hope for Tomorrow by Seastock. You can subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, YouTube or anywhere else where podcasts are found. I'll be back with new episodes soon, but in the meantime, stay safe and, as much as possible under the circumstances, here's to more home adventures.